Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Health Care and Human Services. It is February 10th, and there is one bill that we are moving to Thursday, Senate Bill 1579, so that will not be heard today. That will be moved to Thursday. So do I need to say anything more? We are carrying this over to Thursday. Okay, and I would like, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1561 and have the Board of Pharmacy, OMA, and ONA please come forward.
Let this work this one out.
This one's going away.
Chairman Lois Anderson and committee, my name is Marcus Watt. I'm the newly appointed executive director of the Board of Pharmacy. I have to apologize a little bit. I'm a brand new employee. I've only been with the state 6 days, so I'm still coming up to speed on this.
Madam Chair, can we put him in charge of COVID Oregon?
Again, I'm not sure what led to the disagreement that we'd had in the past, but the Board of Pharmacy, myself, we are committed to ongoing.
Well, first, before we do that, I should have Sandy describe the bill for the
thank
public.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1561 exempts the establishment where a practitioner dispenses drugs from laws and rules related to regulation as drug outlets if the establishment and or practitioner meet other specified criteria. The bill had has an emergency and is effective on passage. And we had multiple amendments, but we won't go through those now.
No.
Again, I don't know the history, but the Board of Pharmacy and myself are committed to ongoing dialogue and collaboration with all the various stakeholders to craft a solution for this in the future. I can commit to you today that if we can create a non-legislative work group to work on this, that the Board of Pharmacy will make no rule regarding practitioner dispensing prior to the end of the 2015 session.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Chair Munoz Anderson, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association. We just want to thank the committee for giving us some time on this issue. We want to thank the new executive director of the Board of Pharmacy. We're looking forward to developing a relationship with him and his board to ensure what we all agree is the number one priority for all of our organizations and our boards, which is public safety. We want to underscore that rules and regulations should only be written if there is a public safety need and concern that's well documented. And we do not need rules and duplicative oversight by third-party boards unless there is evidence that the current board's oversight is insufficient. So we, again, are looking forward to having some good discussions on this issue, and hopefully we'll be not have to come back here, but if we do, we'll all be coming back here together again.
Chair Munoz Anderson, members of the committee, Sarah Basler for the Oregon Nurses Association. We appreciate the willingness of the Board of Pharmacy to revisit this issue and to slow down the rulemaking process. ONA looks forward to working productively and collaboratively with the Board of Pharmacy, the other licensing boards that regulate dispensing providers, and the and professional associations that represent those providers towards a long-term solution that protects patient safety, avoids redundant regulations on providers, and doesn't create an access issue for patients. It's our hope that the next series of conversations will be data-driven and will use the existing regulatory structure of the licensing boards as a foundation and first avenue to address legitimate concerns about dispensing practices and patient safety. I would just add that one of our frustrations that led us to initially pursue a legislative solution was that we hadn't heard specific areas of weakness within the current structure or seen data to back up the need for additional regulation. So I'll echo OMA in saying we hope this will be a focus moving forward, and we're ready and eager to work together.
Great. And I think for the record, we do have your memorandum of understanding that we have on file, and it's posted on OLIS.
It will be as soon as
it will be.
Yeah.
On,
we just
on
got
OLIS.
It right before the hearing.
And that was signed by the Board of Pharmacy, Medical Association, Nurses Association, and the Dental Association.
Correct.
All right. Well, with that, we have our first bill that dies. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1561 and go to my list, figure out, I would like to... open a, we're moving that, open a work session on Senate Bill 1526. Senator Steiner Hayward, bring us up to date on where we are on that bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17 and chief sponsor of Senate Bill 1526. As you may remember, when we heard this bill last week, this bill was targeted at offering families an opportunity to get their kids on the same commercial health plan, subsidized commercial health plan, as opposed to having them on OHP. Many of you on the committee, I think, are well aware of some of the conversations that have happened around this bill. I'd like to clarify a couple of points. The first is, it never even occurred to me that some people might perceive this as being done as a way to save Cover Oregon. The number of people involved and the premiums it would, fees it would theoretically generate would not come close to dealing with this issue, and I'm frankly a little disappointed that anybody thought that, but it had never even crossed my mind until somebody else said it. The second is that you will see before you a dash 2 amendment that makes the effective date of this bill August 21st of 2015, 30 days after the end of 60 days, some long period of time, after the end of constitutional sine die in the 2015 session. The point of doing it this way, Madam Chair, is to require the authority to come back to us in the 2015 session with a plan, with a fiscal, and so that this committee and other relevant legislative bodies, committees can evaluate it properly and make sure that we're doing this in the ways that both protect family choice, allow family choice, and also protect children's health care. And we make sure that we're working and balancing a lot of different needs. So I fully support the dash 2 amendments and hope that the committee will agree to adopt them. The third is this.
This question.
Certainly.
Now, in that amendment, it takes away the 130.
No, Madam Chair, there's a dash 1 amendment that did that, I believe.
And that is going away.
Yeah, that's what I was just getting to.
Oh,
yes, thank
sorry,
you, Madam
sorry.
Chair.
Yes.
So, yes, I had hoped personally that we could expand this down to, I think it's actually technically 133. Don't ask me about the percentages. Even OHA says it's complicated to explain. But there is significant apprehension about dropping the level that low. Because of the number of children involved. Experience would suggest that the percentage of families that would actually take advantage of this is pretty small, so the likelihood that this would disrupt the CCO system strikes me as also very small. That being said, I appreciate the concerns as we still work to develop the CCOs, and so I'm comfortable leaving it at 200% to 300%. So at this point, Madam Chair, the only remaining amendment is the dash 2s, which would make this bill not go into effect until late August of 2015, thereby offering this committee the opportunity to evaluate a formal plan for this in the 15 session.
Great. Questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Steiner Hayward, I appreciate the fact that you want the health authority to come back to us with a plan. I appreciate that. I guess my comfort level, the way you're describing it, I would prefer that if they come back with a plan and we like it, that at that point we take affirmative action to go forward rather than the reverse.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I apologize for not being clear. By making this not take effect until August of 2015 and therefore be in the next biennium, we have not approved any fiscal on this, and there will be an associated fiscal, and therefore we will have to approve the plan in order to send it to Ways and Means in order to get the fiscal approved in order for it to take effect. If, in fact, we don't pass a bill in 2015, this will not take effect because there will be an associated fiscal. That's my understanding, having spoken with Legislative Council and the Health Authority.
I guess, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. It's like we tell an agency to go forth and bring us back something, I always like it for us to have to do something specifically affirmative. And the way you were describing it was, if we do, I mean, clearly it's a budget issue at that point, I understand that, but clearly it takes effect without any action at all.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I actually agree with you, and I worked very closely with Legislative Council on this issue, and it was Legislative Council's advice, and it was Ms. Freeman, who I consider a very experienced drafter and well-versed in how to make these things work, who recommended that we do it this way, because historically requiring an agency to come forward prospectively with a plan the next session has been more complex. We can certainly reconsider if you feel very strongly about this. I plan to introduce a bill in the 2015 session that relates to this issue completely and that would be working with the OHA to develop the plan. And frankly, I'll say publicly that if we can't come up with a plan in a fiscal that makes it workable in good ways, then we can gut and stuff it, and we can tell it that it doesn't take effect at all.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And I don't think we need anyone else to talk on this bill right now, so we are going to carry this over to... I'd like to just carry it over to tomorrow.
I would hope that since there's nothing going on, we can get a fiscal and a revenue by then. Yes, with the dash twos? I would think.
Okay, let's we will do our best to, and we will carry Senate Bill 1526 over until tomorrow, February 11th. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1526. And Representative Hoyle, you're on Senate Bill 1577, so I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1577.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1577 requires the Department of State Police and all sheriffs and municipal police departments to adopt written policies related to missing vulnerable adults on or before January 1, 2015. Specifies that the missing adults include... includes... for whom the law enforcement official has received a signed statement stating that the missing adult has impaired mental condition, intellectual or developmental disability, or brain injury. The bill also has in it requires the Oregon Health Authority to request specified information from potential contractors, and if certain conditions are met, to request those proposals to establish and operate systems and technologies designed to detect and prevent improper payments in the state medical assistance program. You have a dash one amendment that deletes outdated language that is no longer required by the police.
All right. I will defer to my Senate colleague.
Okay. Senator Canope.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, State Senator Tim Canope, Senate District 27, representing Redmond, Bend, Tumalo, and Sun River. Today we bring you Senate Bill 1577. It is a bill that we hope will essentially save lives, and it's a bill that we believe that will benefit seniors in a significant way. And essentially what we're trying to do is make sure that law enforcement is coordinating with other agencies and the public as we continue to have these issues of seniors wandering from their care facilities. And we've had some significant high-profile examples of that, both in the metro area and in Bend in the last month. And thankfully, I think at least all the ones in Bend that I know of were found in a short period of time. But this is going to continue to be a problem because the population is aging, and we have the effect of Alzheimer's and dementia issues continuing to grow. And part of this came out of our elder abuse work group, which many people, including Majority Leader Hoyle, have been working on for some time. And we believe this is going to be one of the good bills that comes out of this session. The second part of the bill is an opportunity, really, for the state to save money. It's an opportunity to move from kind of a reactive mode as it relates to Medicaid fraud and recovery of overpayments and such in Medicaid, and it moves us toward new technology and predictive analytics to try to stop the fraudulent payments before they happen. And it's probably one of the only bills this session that will save, has the potential to save significant amounts of money that could be used, obviously, to benefit people who are truly in need as it relates to healthcare. And with that, I would be happy to turn it over to my colleague.
Representative Val Hoyle, House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City and Cheshire. We don't want to forget Cheshire. First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and also want to thank Senator Knope for bringing this idea forward. As we've seen, the Amber Alert system has saved many, many children, and the Silver Alert system is based on that. So effectively, it directs the state police and sheriffs and municipal police departments to create standards and policies to alert the public of missing elderly people. And as we've seen, we have an aging population. Right now, one out of nine people have Alzheimer's, and one out of three people over the age of 85. One of my first jobs when I was in college was as a caretaker at a home for women with Alzheimer's. And these people really don't have the ability to find their way home. When they do go wander off, and we talk about protecting the most vulnerable, I think this is one of the most important things we can do. Again, I very much appreciate Senator Knope for bringing it forward. In our elder abuse work group, we spoke about it. There's strong support, and as co-chair of that work group, I would like to strongly support this bill, and I would urge an aye vote. This is one of those good bills that should pass and will really make a difference in people's lives.
I thank you so much for testifying. My father, Bud Moniz, wandered away from Courtyard Fountains, which is located in Gresham, and this bill is very important to me. He fell in the Kmart parking lot, and thank goodness he was fairly well known in my community. Someone drove by going to church and saw him and picked him up, and they knew him, and they knew how to contact me. If that hadn't happened, the police would have been called, and there really needs to be some system for them on how to deal with those who do wander away. So thank you.
I'd point out that virtually this entire committee is sponsors of the bill, so it probably
I think we're all sponsors.
We'd love more sponsors as well as we go through this process. So we're hopeful over in the House, once it gets over there, we'll be able to circulate.
And I talked with the agency on the Medicaid fraud piece, and they I don't think anyone's going to come up and testify, but definitely in favor of that piece of the legislation also. Or maybe they're neutral on the bill, but they had no opposition to it.
Madam Chair, we also have a Dash 1 amendment, and that was brought forward by essentially by law enforcement. And it kind of removed the provision where you had to fill out a form to get the process started, basically, I think is what this does. So it seemed like a reasonable request, and I think both the chiefs of police and the sheriff's associations were supportive of the bill itself, along with a lot of other organizations, and we really do appreciate their support, and especially the Alzheimer's Association, who helped bring this forward.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The only other person is Dan Jarman, who, and I don't know if Kevin, does anyone from the Chief of Police want to put their view?
Sure, yes, please.
Yeah.
And I'm still on the phone.
Who's that? And you are?
John Bartholomew.
Oh, yes, John.
You're
next.
No, John.
Yes.
Are you here for 1577?
Of course.
Yes. Yes, the autism. I'm sorry.
No.
Alzheimer's Association.
Alzheimer's.
I'm so confused.
Yes. Okay.
Do you want me to go?
We forgot.
Andy has the two busiest committees, and with all these bills, we understand.
I'm so sorry.
Okay. Let's have John testify, and then we'll have you. Okay, John, please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity and for allowing me to testify via phone. I very much appreciate it, given all the weather circumstances. And I'll be very brief. For the record, this is John Bartholomew. I am the Public Policy Director for the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter. There are currently over 80,000 Oregonians with Alzheimer's, and that's expected to climb to over 110,000 by 2025, and 60% of these folks will wander at some point. And 60% of those folks, if not found within 24 hours, will suffer a severe injury or death. And that increases up to 80% if not found within 72 hours. So this is a really fantastic program, or a fantastic piece of legislation that addresses one of the key solutions to helping keep these people safe. I mean, it's a multi-layered approach. You know, our organization has the MedAlert Safe Return Program. Some counties, like Washington County, have special programs that people can register to be part of a special program to prevent wandering and also be found easily with a tracking device. But, you know, and then there's the safety standards in long-term care settings. But even with all of that, there will be people who get out and law enforcement will be called. And what this bill essentially does is make sure that every police and sheriff department in Oregon has thought about how they're going to approach this and has a formal policy. Now, I really appreciate everything that Senator Knope has done to promote this and spread the word, as well as the committee as a whole, because this is something that is really critical for our state and for thousands of families impacted by Alzheimer's in Oregon. So thank you again for considering this, and we urge your support.
Thank you, John, so much. Dan?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman today representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Just very briefly, I wanted to, more than anything, share our support for this legislation on behalf of the broadcasters and to thank John Bartholomew of the Alzheimer's Association for working with us on this legislation. Lobbyists don't often get a pat on the back for their good work. He contacted us last summer, talked about the legislation. We worked with each other to make sure, at the end of the day, the Amber Alert system was not weakened by this. I think this legislation has really evolved into something that's very, very good. The broadcasters are very proud of working with policymakers here in Oregon to implement the Amber Alert. So the way this legislation has evolved has really worked out very well for us. We want to show our support for this legislation, and thanks for the association for working with us, and we hope the committee passes the legislation today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'd echo some of the comments that Mr. Jarman made about Mr. Bartholomew reaching out to our association early. We had a number of conversations, had similar initial concerns about not wanting to impact the Amber Alert, which, as you know, has a very important capability and can handle things that involve statewide tragedies involving missing children. But it became apparent that the opportunity here was to encourage all agencies, police agencies, sheriff's departments, to have a written policy so that we know exactly what to do if and when a missing person, missing vulnerable adult, comes to the notice of a law enforcement agency. One of the things I really appreciate about this is it does not become overly prescriptive about what actually has to happen community to community. Even among the legislators who sit here, your communities that you represent differ. And there are different resources available to different agencies when a missing person needs to be located. And we believe that the local community is the best one to determine how to get the word out and how to most effectively marshal resources quickly in order to find somebody who's missing in the quickest possible time. Obviously, if you're in the Portland metro area, you have a different amount of broadcast media and other media opportunities. In rural Oregon, you may have very little of that, but you have other resources at your disposal that can be mobilized. And so this gives us a chance to raise the flag around the importance of missing vulnerable adults and what happens to families and to that individual when they go missing. And so I am very thankful for the approach to this bill, the sponsors of this bill, and we're eager to get to work to make sure that all agencies do have a policy so they know exactly what to do when this happens. I will say that most agencies do have a policy right now. We want to make sure that that extends to every agency in the state. So I want to, again, extend my thanks to the committee for hearing this bill and urge your support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me. There's no one else signed up? Or wait.
No.
Looks like we have everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. We do not have the fiscal, is my understanding. Sandy, is that correct?
That is correct.
So I would like to carry Senate Bill 1577 over until tomorrow to see if we have the fiscal. No, Mary Peterson. Was she going to testify on the Medicaid fraud piece? Yeah.
Judy Moore Peterson?
Judy.
No.
No? Was she?
No,
she wasn't.
She was going to be here in case of questions.
In case of questions, okay. All right, then we're fine.
Do you want to move the ones and her?
Okay, all right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1577. You don't need to say anything.
Okay.
All right. come up.
don't force her.
Okay. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1577, and would the agency put on record their
neutrality
on the Medicaid fraud piece?
Yes, for the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Director of Medical Assistance Programs with the Oregon Health Authority, and we are neutral on the bill, and we do not have any negative things regarding the Medicaid fraud provisions.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. I saw you walking out, and I thought, oh, dear, I didn't ask someone from the agency to come up. Okay.
And she didn't really want to, but you forced her.
I did. All right. So I'll close. Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1577 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1577.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I move the dash one amendment dated 1/29/14 to Senate Bill 1577.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1577. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I will close the public work session on Senate Bill 1577, and we are moving this bill over until tomorrow,
unless
we get our fiscal.
Could you pause for just a
yes.
moment?
Thanks.
Yes, thank
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, John. Sorry about the mess up on my part.
Will we have the fiscal today?
Madam Chair, fiscal said he thought we could have it at 3. So we are in a holding pattern with it, but I don't know what their workload is like, so I don't want to make any promises.
The fact that I closed, can we reopen?
Yes.
All right. So
you're
we're
not,
fine. I closed
not.
It.
50, can we move the amendment on 1526?
We don't have it.
Oh, you don't have the amendment? The dash two? Oh, no, we can't because we didn't have had it for an hour.
Correct.
Never mind.
Okay. All right. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1562. Tom Holt.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. 1562.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1562 modifies the requirement for health insurance coverage of services, medications, and supplies necessary for the management of diabetes during pregnancy. You have the dash T. Here's a written sheet. You have the dash two amendments that we got this morning, and you should have the dash. There were some dash one amendments previously. The dash,
okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, John Powell, Tom Holt, Courtney Dresser. Doesn't look like Tom's here. Okay.
He doesn't have to come up.
So where are these amendments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Senate Bill 1562 is before you during legislative days for a brief hearing. And as you'll recall, in the 2013 session, legislation was passed to create a first dollar benefit for pregnant women who are diabetic during from conception through 6 months postpartum. And that bill passed. This bill make some technical changes to that, not to the overall policy. One of the main thrusts of the bill is to say that the benefit would accrue to the devices and strips, for example, test strips that diabetics use that are on the formulary that the insurer carries, so that the discounts given for those products would carry through to the beneficiary and to the health plan and other members. So that's one of the main thrusts. The other technical change was to give the health plan notice. We would not know that the person is pregnant. We might know they're diabetic from their previous prescriptions, but we would not necessarily know they're pregnant.
Yeah.
The amendment that you have, the -2 amendment, is actually going to be carried by Courtney, who has worked with Regents to develop the plan on notification. So I turn that over to her.
Good afternoon, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. First of all, the OMA is very supportive of the bill, Senate Bill 1562. We just needed to clarify the last part of the bill about notification. As written, was a bit burdensome. It could have been very burdensome for clinics and providers. So we changed the language just a little bit to talk about an oral notification and a timely manner for that notification. Thank you to Regents for working with us on that, and we all agree to that amendment.
And that is the -1s.
Two.
The -2. So the -1s are out, and the -2s are in.
Correct.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, I might also mention on line 1011 on the printed bill, federal law does not allow health savings accounts to have this kind of a benefit, and this simply notes that according to the federal law, and actually specifies the federal law. And the reason for that is that there are tax benefits to those plans. And so the federal law says that these kinds of first dollar mandates cannot apply to those health savings accounts.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
I should remember, since I was a co-chief on this bill last year, but I thought we included a preconception period since we were trying to get women's blood sugars under control before they got pregnant last year. I'd have to go back in and look at the statute because I'm not looking at it in front of me right this second.
If you look at the printed bill, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, if you look at the printed bill, lines 5 through 9 is the existing language from the bill.
Uh-huh.
And it says supplies that are medically necessary for a woman to manage her diabetes from conception through 6 weeks postpartum. I think I said 6 months. I meant
we 6 weeks. So we didn't end up including the preconception period?
No.
Okay.
We would like to be notified during that period. But
well, we can't always be notified during the preconception period because 50% of pregnancies are still unplanned, Mr. Powell, no matter how hard we try.
There's only been one of those that I know of.
Okay. Moving right along.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Powell.
Good one, John.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Jen, could you explain to me again kind of the underlying bill from last session and what we're trying to fix here? Just maybe it's not clicking for me.
Okay. Madam Chair and Senator Shields, if you look at lines 5 through 9 of the printed bill, that's without the bold print, is the existing law and really the guts of what was done last session. And that simply says that a health plan may not require a co-payment or co-insurance or deductible on covered services, medication supplies that are medically necessary for a woman to manage her diabetes during pregnancy. So from conception to 6 weeks postpartum, they get first dollar coverage for those, for their strips, their pumps, whatever it is. And the technical fix that we're working on here is the health plan needs to know that as soon as they possibly can in order to adjust the benefits appropriately. Because what you're doing is you're changing the benefit as you move through time and then changing it back.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
There's no one else signed up to testify, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1562 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1562.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1562.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1562. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And we do not have the fiscal yet, so I am going to carry Senate Bill 1562 over till tomorrow, and hopefully we'll have it. And with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1562 and open. Senator Courtney's supposed to be here.
I don't see him. He's hard to miss.
1582.
Yeah, 1582.
You can start with some other folks.
Okay. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1582 and call up Jeremy, DJ Vogt, and Betsy Earls. But if Peter comes in, I would like you guys to step aside. Okay, Courtney.
Madam Chair.
Westerling, right?
Westling.
I was close. Westling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Courtney Westling, formerly Thompson, Director of Ledge Affairs for the Oregon Health Authority. While we're waiting for Senator Courtney, I just wanted to come up and give you a couple of the details on this bill. Essentially, this bill extends the OMIP program under a new name called TMIP, which is the Temporary Medical Insurance Pool, and it will allow for folks who previously were on OMIP, which sunsetted at the end of the year, 2013, it allows them to have some a place to go while they're transitioning to either the exchange or other places. And so right now, we feel pretty confident that there are about 1,400 TMIP members right now that have enrolled. Paid their premiums. So we find that the way that we're going to pay for those folks is by using the premium tax, the ending balance in the premium tax account, and we feel good that that'll cover it. But it's all in this bill. It includes the statutory language that's necessary to make sure that that happens and that that's the first place that we go, and that will cover those folks. Again, right now there's only about 1,400 people out of the 10,300 approximate number that were in the OMIP program. So the other folks that are not in that 1,400 have already gone elsewhere. So we're hoping to get that 1,400 moved off quickly. But in the meantime, this will give them a soft place to land. So that's kind of the 101.
And Senator Courtney, if you join us, please.
Madam Chair, if I could, you mentioned the assessment, which is what has funded OMIP, but you also mentioned the ending balance. That confused me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The insurer's tax that sunsetted, the ending balance in that account.
Oh, in that account.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Who's that guy?
Thank you. Senator Courtney.
Chairman Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator. And this building is in my Senate district. I don't want you to forget that. And I represent major portions of Salem, Jervis, and Woodbury. District 11. I want to thank you for even being willing to hear this piece of legislation and letting me testify. I introduced this bill in response to the challenges that some Oregonians, I was told, are having trouble signing up for the insurance through Cover Oregon. I was told that this is necessary to help those individuals. The bill funds the temporary medical insurance pool. It basically extends OMIP the state's high-risk insurance pool for 3 months to make sure people who need their insurance don't fall through the cracks while they transition to insurance through Cover Oregon or directly from insurers. When I first requested this measure, there were over 10,000 people, I'm told, in OMIP who would have been eligible for TMIP. You know, they got these letters down here. And I'm just giving you the letters, so I assume you know what the letters mean. So do not ask me what those letters mean. Some 1,300 Oregonians have paid their portion of the premium to show that this coverage is crucially important. These are people with pre-existing medical conditions that previously couldn't get health insurance through commercial market. These are people who are possibly one ailment away from bankruptcy. They cannot be without health insurance. This bill provides for temporary coverage to allow them additional time to get enrolled to Cover Oregon or on the commercial market. I'm not going to get into the technicalities of this bill for a very good reason. You could trip me up if you did that. I'll just make a straight statement to you. I'm not the smartest kid in the class on this. There are other people here that can talk to you about all those technicalities or questions regarding all the intricacies of this. I am told that this is a very important piece of legislation for this session. It has nothing to do, I'm told, about partisan politics or rural versus urban. These are people that we all care about. We want them to get insurance. They're in need of it. And that this is a piece of legislation that is beneficial, that is well put together. Once again, I do appreciate Chairman Ellis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, your willingness to schedule the bill, at least allow me to come and say some words on it.
Thank you very much. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. And Ms. President, I'm not asking you this question. So I guess one of my concerns here, I mean, we hear rumors from D.C. all the time about delayed implementation of this and that. Now they're talking 16, which is interesting. So my question would be, is 3 months enough time, or should we be more open-ended on this, considering what's going on in D.C.?
Senator Cruz, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, the way that this bill is written, it terminates at the end of March of this year, but there is language to make it flexible if the federal government changes open enrollment. But our intention is to get all these folks off of the TMIP program as soon as we can. We have an outreach strategy to call aggressively. We're working with Project Access to make those calls and to reach all these members so that we can help assist them to get from TMIP to either Cover Oregon or the commercial market.
Okay, you understand my concern. Mm-hmm. So, if I could, Madam Chair, you know, if open enrollment goes, if they roll that back to 16, what does that do?
This goes through March.
This goes through mm-hmm. March, but you said there's provisions if the feds extend.
There was some flexibility in the language around that, so that if they extended, but, you know, I may be wrong, and I don't want to tell you that, because our intention is to end the program March 31st and move people okay. off in time for that deadline.
Okay.
But the question had come up about, well, what if the federal government extends open enrollment?
Right.
So I want to make sure that language is right, okay. and I'll get back to you.
Can I be allowed to speak, Chair Monsanto?
Yes, please.
Chair Monsanto and Vice Chair Cruz, there's at least one member of this committee was involved in a conversation in which I got into deadlines a few weeks ago. I'm looking at that person right now. And I went ballistic on this to say, I'd rather go too long than too short. So the question asked by the good representative, Senator Jeff Cruz, this is as good a committee as you can get when it comes to health care. I said 3 months. We better not come up short. And I'm not talking to you. I'm talking about the certified smarts in the room. I have asked that question, and I have pounded on that question. So please, be sure that we're right on this 3 months thing. That's all I'm going to say. I'm talking to you because you're that good, and I mean that collective individual. I'm not messing around here. I'm really pleased you asked that question. I mean, I have to say it that way.
Madam Chair, I agree. I just don't want to see collateral damage. Okay. I mean, that's, you know, to a degree with the way everything's evolving, both here in the state of Oregon and at the national level, I'm not sure that some people might not fall through the cracks on this.
And we have it on the greatest authority from the health authority that this is reasonable.
Yes.
Yes, Senator Knoe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to Courtney, first name, not last name. I do have questions for last name Courtney, but they deal with his plow truck ride-along, not this particular topic. So I'm going to go with the first name, Courtney.
Impossible.
Courtney, what is left in the fund that we would use, and will there be any money left when this 3 months is up based on the number of people who you intend to cover?
Senator Knope, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, it's my understanding that the ending balance is around $7 million. It's my understanding that the total that it would take to cover those in team up today, approximately $5 million. So if I'm doing my math right, it covers them.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just had one last question for Courtney. I have some questions.
Does that mean I leave?
In which January?
You're Courtney.
First name Courtney.
Oh, first name Courtney?
First name Courtney.
You know, can I just say something, Chairman Sanderson, too?
Yes, please.
I have three sons. I never had a daughter. I love my last name so much. Had I had a daughter, I was going to name her Courtney Courtney.
And there you are, sitting next to this lovely young
lady.
You could adopt.
So I want to stay while there's some more questions for Courtney, because I just love that name.
All right. Madam Chair, I did ask some questions regarding this topic in January, and was promised some answers, and I'm hoping that I didn't miss those in my email box. So if we could get those, that would be exceptional.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Courtney and Courtney. All right. Jeremy Vandehay, DJ, is it Vogue? And Betsy Earls, Annalise Brown.
We only have three chairs.
I know. We only have three chairs, but that's who's in the queue.
They can go back and forth. It works.
All right.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehay with Kaiser Permanente. Thanks for the opportunity to provide some testimony in support of this bill with the Dash 3. I think both President Courtney and First Name Courtney did a great job outlining what's in the bill. I think there's been a good consensus process. I want to thank President Courtney's office, Governor's office, OHA, OID, for quickly working on a resolution to this. We do support the legislation. We just urge that you adopt the Dash 3s and move the bill today.
Great.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Elise Brown for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And just to tag along what Jeremy Vandehay just said on behalf of Kaiser, that the process was an open, inclusive process, a couple meetings back and forth with Courtney and Sean Colmer in the governor's office, and we're here to signal our support and general agreement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, DJ Vogt, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Business Association. Echoing the same comments, we at OBH support the Dash 3 amendment. It was a very open and collaborative process to get to this point. We feel the funding mechanism does make sense and maintains TMIP program as it should be. We believe the bill is sound and should pass. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. Obviously, you've heard all about the TMIP program and what House Senate Bill 1582 will do for the program to transition people from OMIP into commercial insurance. I think the main value of our testimony here, besides telling you that we support this process, TMIP, is to let you know that the second tier of funding, if the premium, the balance in the premium tax doesn't hold out for this, is slated to be money from the reinsurance pool, which we supported in House Bill 3458 last session. We supported the creation of that reinsurance program. And I just wanted to be clear with you that our support for the reinsurance program extends to our support for perhaps having to use that funding to get the TMIP participants through from OMIP until they get onto a commercial insurance program. And we do understand that the cap that we agreed on last session in 3458 on the reinsurance money would stay in place if we had to get to that point, although it doesn't sound like we're going to need to. So, but I just wanted to put that on the record and urge your support.
Thank you. Questions? All right. And then who's left? That's everybody?
Yep.
All right. All right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1582 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1582.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to Senate Bill 1582.
Senator Cruz moves the -3 amendments into Senate Bill 1582. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1582 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1582 as amended with the -3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I still have some concerns with the time frame. Quite honestly, we have heard from agencies in this building for the last couple of years a whole lot of assurances that haven't necessarily proven true. So I'm just hoping that 3 months is enough.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Senator Cruz. Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steinmeier-Hewitt.
Aye.
Senator Knope.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman Sanders.
Aye. Motion carries, and it's on its way. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1582 and open a public hearing on 1548.
Oh, Senator Rosenbaum, sir.
Oh, Senator Rosenbaum. No, sorry, I'm going to temporarily close that. No, I'm not.
Oh, I'm so sorry. 42.
Yeah. I will. We will not open a public hearing yet on Senate Bill 1548, but open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1542. Senator Rosenbaum. 42.
And Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I was watching you upstairs, and I thought that our bill was up next.
That's. I'm happy to have you.
Okay.
It is.
Great. So did you already open a hearing on it?
I opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 1542, and
you're capable
staff
should to explain it.
And do you want to explain
that? Sure.
It?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1542 allows private payers to hire home care workers through a registry maintained by the Home Care Commission. It requires the commission to establish payment rates for the private payers based on the cost. On the cost to the commission and to establish a classification for home care workers. Madam Chair, you have a pretty substantial -1 amendment that we just received today, so I cannot tell you a section-by-section change from the original bill, but I think that will be highlighted for us.
Great.
Thank you. Now, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Diane Rosenbaum, State Senator from District 21 in Southeast and Northeast Portland, and Milwaukee and Oak Grove in Clackamas County, and I'm very pleased to be able to testify in support of Senate Bill 1542 and the -1 amendments, which Sandy referred to. I believe that the committee did hold an informational hearing on this bill in the interim, so I think that you're somewhat familiar with what we're talking about, and I'll just briefly tell you what the bill is intended to do and why it's necessary. Senate Bill 1542 basically deals with a large and growing problem that all of us will eventually face either in our own lives or when we're dealing with elderly parents or disabled relatives who need somebody to come into their home and provide assistance with so many of the things that enable our seniors to stay in their homes and be able to avoid living in an institution as long as possible. I know, speaking for myself, that a few years ago, my own father, who's now 91 and a retired math teacher and sharp as a tack, was hospitalized due to some pretty serious neurological problems and some other problems, and then went to a nursing home and then went back to his own home where he's lived on his own for several years. And I can tell you, he doesn't live in Oregon. He lives in the Seattle area. But my sister and I, trying to scramble to find people to come in to assist him with just the basic daily activities of making meals and bathing and taking his medications on time, particularly when we weren't going to be around and be able to be there with him every day, was really nerve-wracking. And if you've had that experience with your own parents, you know how hard that can be. So the intention of Senate Bill 1542 is to take an existing tool that we have here in Oregon, which is our state home care registry, and make it available to people who are not on Medicaid. So currently, and I'm sure the committee members are familiar with the home care system that we have, people who are on Medicaid can access a list of home care workers who have been through background checks and training, and then be able to match up their needs with somebody on that registry. And this bill would make that registry available to people who are paying privately. So right now, if you aren't on Medicaid, you're basically able to go out and do your own hiring by putting an ad on a bulletin board or putting an ad on Craigslist or using a private agency, but you cannot use the registry in the way that people on Medicaid can, and this will correct that. It'll provide a third option that I think will address a critical gap in this kind of care. We'll also make the care more affordable, because using the registry, basically the only additional fee would be the administrative costs of maintaining the background checks and the things that we currently do through the Home Care Commission. And that will enable Oregonians, whether they're seniors or disabled individuals or the family members of those people, to hire somebody who's trained, who's got a background check, and who meets the needs of that person. This is also important, I think, for people in rural areas of our state, where, as I'm sure members know, there really is a shortage of caregivers. Our home care registry has caregivers in every one of the 36 counties in Oregon, and it can often be very difficult, especially in those outlying areas, to find somebody who can meet the needs of the individual. I think basically that is what the bill does. The Dash 1 amendments, as were referred to by the committee staff, have been worked out through the stakeholders and the Home Care Commission, and other witnesses that you're going to hear from will go through section by section exactly what the Dash 1 amendments do. So in closing, I would just urge the members to look favorably on this bill. I think for every one of us, you know, whether we have somebody in our family now or, you know, as our population is aging, we want seniors and disabled individuals to be able to stay in their own homes and live independently for as long as possible. And Oregon is really a national model in that kind of care. I forgot to mention what's alluded to in my testimony, that we have been written up in the New York Times and other places for our existing home care referral system, because it's such a great tool, but it can be a much more useful tool than it is right now if we broaden its application and allow people who are better off than individuals on Medicaid to use this and hire people through the system. And so I would just commend the bill and the amendments to you and hope that you can move it expeditiously from your committee with a due pass recommendation. It does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and so that is where it's hopefully headed. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Snow.
Thank you, Chairman Sanderson. I'm not really familiar with the registry, so can you tell me, does the registry have both union and non-union members on it? What, you know, basically what kind of checks do they go through to be able to provide the service, those types of things?
So I think that there are staff from the Home Care Commission here in the room that can answer those questions better than I. They do receive criminal background checks. I think other kind of background checks, too. They receive training. And as to your question about whether you have to be a union member to be on here, I don't think you have to be a union member, but my understanding is the folks on this registry are represented. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's call, thank you, Senator Rosenbaum, Lee Myers, Megan Moyer, and Rick Bennett. And let's...
Go ahead, you go. Hi, my name is Lee Myers, Chairman Monsanderson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today and on behalf of the Senate bill. I'm a retired home care worker from Medford. I've spent more than 20 years providing in-home care for older adults and assisting them with their daily activities, such as eating, dressing, bathing, shopping, anything they need to keep them in their home. I loved that I was helping to clients maintain their independent lives in their homes. It just makes their lives so much happier. I know it isn't easy to make the decision to invite a home care worker into your home. Everybody wants the best care for their loved one to make them happier and keep them safe. My personal standard of care was to take care of my clients the way I'd want my parents taken care of. But to me, that was pretty high because I really loved my parents. Throughout my career, I worked alongside many good home care workers who, like me, gave selflessly to those in need. But unfortunately, not all of my clients received the same high-quality care that I brought to my day-to-day work. I started my career in 1990, before the Home Care Commission Registry existed, when people relied heavily on word of mouth or the help wanted section of the local newspaper to hire us. Sadly, it was not uncommon for my clients and their families to have had bad experiences. Some home care workers cultivated personal relationships with their clients so that they could manipulate them to buy expensive gifts, pay their rent, or loan them money that was never repaid. The worst offense I heard of was a home care worker who talked a client into signing her home over to her. One home care worker had an inappropriate relationship with a client where professional boundaries were crossed. Others took things from my clients like jewelry, credit cards, silverware, medication, even tools. Then there were the cases where the home care worker was not a good fit. They lacked training, didn't understand how to care for the needs of the client, or put minimal effort into their work. Once the Home Care Commission Registry was put in place, the abuse and mistreatment drastically declined for my Medicaid clients. The quality of care improved so much that they would hire home care workers who received proper training once they could and passed their criminal background checks. The registry is a tremendous resource. It's working well for Oregonians whose home care is paid for by Medicaid. But for individuals who don't have Medicaid assistance, finding the best service can be a nightmare when they cannot hire through the registry. These individuals and their families can either hire the home care worker directly as an employee or use an agency. Going through an agency is incredibly expensive. Some agencies also are very limited on what their home care workers can do. This means multiple people must be brought into the client's home to provide supplemental services, such as house cleaning, laundry, or shopping, or if for personal care, they don't get to do both. while hiring a home care worker at your own, on your own can save costs, families carry the responsibilities of being an employer, abiding tax and labor laws. When you don't hire through a reliable source, it's also difficult to know if the home care worker has a strong home care employment record or if they've been convicted of a crime. Senate Bill 1542 puts the state in charge of handling the administrative aspects of the in-home caregiver's employment, not the family. This state manages payroll and legal documentation, withholding and filing taxes, workers' compensation, and unemployment. Because the state is only recouping the administrative costs rather than trying to make a profit, the cost to consumers will be lower, enabling more Oregonians to afford in-home care. Most importantly, Senate Bill 1542 will increase the safety and peace of mind for all aging home care Oregonians and people with disabilities. The bill enables them to hire a quality home care worker who has passed a background check and received special training that matches the unique needs of each client.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union. I had the opportunity to speak in front of this committee during the January days, so I'm going to keep my comments primarily to the Dash 1 amendments, but I would like to draw your attention to some written testimony that has been submitted. We had some individuals who were unable to make it due to inclement weather and other conflicts, but we do have two consumer stories that I would like to draw your attention to. One is from Don Morgan, and the other is from Tom Chamberlain, both who've had experiences hiring or struggles hiring home care workers. I'd also like to draw your attention to a sign-on letter of support that lists several organizations who represent the interests of consumers to this bill. In relationship to the Dash 1 amendments that you received today, this is a product of the SEIU working closely with the Oregon Home Care Commission, the Department of Human Services, the Governor's Office, and the Oregon Health Care Association. Many of the issues we addressed were in order to listen to some concerns from the agency perspective, and I think Oregon Health Care Association can speak specifically to those, but I took that very seriously, and I want to reiterate again that the option of agency home care is an important option that should be available, and this is certainly not in any way meant to attack that. This is simply about more options for seniors. It's a different kind of option. This is a distinctly different program, which some people prefer. Some people prefer agency, and agencies are an important part of our long-term care system. And we took their concerns around this bill seriously and hope that the Dash Ones address that. In Section 2, you'll see a lot of changes in the subsection 1. The intent of the legislation is more clearly laid out, and particularly that this legislation is meant to build and strengthen upon the home care workforce that serves the Medicaid consumers, not compete or in any way diminish that. I think that's very important, that first and foremost, this workforce and the registry is created to serve the Medicaid population, and that continues to be the focus. But we believe that there's a way of expanding to be available to private pay individuals that actually strengthens that workforce and builds upon the skills of that workforce. Subsections 2 through 4 are laid out to address some of the issues of concern to the Oregon Healthcare Association by making sure that information is provided to consumers and that the rules are very clear around what work will can be provided by a home care worker and what work cannot be provided by a home care worker. It also directs the Oregon Home Care Commission to make available a self-assessment tool to help individuals determine if they can self-direct or they can designate someone to self-direct. That's not for everybody. It also has a self-tool to do a care plan that will be used between the worker and the consumer to lay out the scope of work that will be performed. It also is going to make other community resources available for those who may go through that assessment government and realize that this model of care is not right for them, they will be able to easily access other resources like the Aging Disability Resource Center, other agency options, because this is not for every consumer. Subsection 5 lays out how the Oregon Home Care Commission will be calculating what they charge private pay consumers, and it'll also make sure that those calculations are public and available for people to understand. Subsection 6 of 2 requires the services be paid up front. This is important to not create a liability for the state of Oregon. Subsection 7 prohibits that home care workers accept additional payment or compensation for work that is paid through the Oregon Home Care Commission. This is important in order to preserve that we do not create a disincentive to taking Medicaid, that a worker who is paid through the commission will not experience a difference between a private pay consumer or a Medicaid consumer. Under Section 3, we clarify that there will not be any changes to the employment relations concerning a home care worker, so we are not changing any statutes related to in what regards the state is and is not an employer. In Subsection 4, we give the Home Care Commission authority to establish new classifications of workers and the authority to establish payment rates for those workers. This is a process that's already begun as we look at how to greater coordinate care between physical health care and long-term care. We have a project that we are working with the Home Care Commission on around an enhanced home care worker, which would require a much greater level of training, and a home care worker would participate in health care teams and be giving information back and forth and monitoring health conditions for individuals with chronic care needs. So this is to allow that flexibility as we look to greater improve the coordination between long-term care and physical health care. Subsection 5 defines the terms of the bill. So what is private pay consumer and what is private pay? Subsection 6 gives the Oregon Home Care Commission authority to set training and other standards for home care workers providing care to private pay. This is important. We want to make sure that we are not creating a separate tier of workers, but rather that we are going to be holding home care workers who provide private pay services to the same standards as we are establishing for our Medicaid population. This is work that we've seen a lot of progress the last decade in the Home Care Commission. We've now begun to establish continuing ed requirements, train requirements, and the professionalization of this workforce, and want to make sure that that is strengthened and continued through this legislation. Subsections 7 refers to the ability for the Oregon Home Care Commission to adopt criteria for referral through the registry. Right now, if you were to want to get a list of home care workers, it is not a randomized list. We have some policies within the Oregon Home Care Commission that prioritizes within the lists. You select your search criteria. You can select by training, preferences such as you have animals or others. But that list is actually going to come to you in order of the amount of training that a worker has taken through the Oregon Home Care Commission as a way to incentivize that. The intent here is that the commission can create criteria for how referrals are done for private pay consumers that would be in line with what we're currently doing. Sections 9 and 10 clarify for what purposes the state is and is not the employer, which is to be consistent with the role that they currently play with the Medicaid population. They are expressly not the employer for purposes of PERS and PEB, but they will continue for purposes of collective bargaining, unemployment insurance, and establishing qualifications and rate of pay. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead and have Rick, and then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. AARP, from time to time, issues surveys related to caregiving, and the fact is, the vast majority of caregiving being done both here in Oregon and across the country is done by family members for family members. And there's tremendous value to that. However, a more recent report from AARP's Public Policy Institute, and I have it with me, and I can provide an electronic copy to you and your staff if you'd like, but it speaks to the aging of our population, and particularly the aging of our baby boomers, who right now are doing much of that caregiving for their parents. But as our baby boomers age, there's going to be a growing gap between the need for caregiving and those available to give care. And it is with that in mind that we offer our support for this piece of legislation. As the availability of caregivers declines, families are going to have to look to paid care. And we see this bill as just creating another option for consumers to consider when they do have to look at going outside of their own family and paying for the care that's needed. We think there's benefit here in the fact that in considering paid care that you're going to know that in fact individuals you're considering to give that care are trained, that their backgrounds are known, and that's not always the case if you're looking at Craigslist or something. So we see that this is another option for consumers and a good safe option. And we had some initial concerns. We believe the Dash-1 amendments address those concerns. And certainly, we are aware that providers had concerns about this bill. They can speak for themselves, but it's my understanding that the Dash-1 amendments address many of those concerns as well. And again, we support Senate Bill 1542 and would appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Great. Yesterday afternoon, I received an email someone who was against this bill. So I would just want to ask some questions. Would Senate Bill 1542 require a criminal background check?
Senator Mona Sanderson, Megan Moyer. Yes, as it does today, to be on the registry, you must go through the DHS background check unit, and they do what's called a fitness determination. It is both a criminal background check and an abuse registry check.
Great. And would they disclose past acceptable criminal behavior? I mean, is there acceptable criminal behavior? And would the state recommend the elder be bonded or have insurance to protect against theft?
So, as far as what DHS checks when it does a criminal background, it is a criminal record check. There are a list of crimes that are permanently disqualifying. There are others that are disqualifying for a period of time. Then any other crime can be weighed into a fitness determination. Arrests are also considered, as is reports of abuse through DHS or any investigation where a worker is named. It is a thorough check.
Okay, great. Does the state verify the accuracy of the skills that the care provider self-reports that they're proficient at?
I would actually rather have the Home Care Commission address that. I do know that they do verify.
Cheryl, would you come up? Cheryl Myers, from Executive Director of the Home Care Commission, could answer that.
For the record, Senator Moniz Anderson, Chair of this committee, and Senator Cruz, Vice Chair. My name is Cheryl Miller, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Home Care Commission. And your question was about criminal background checks.
Well, that's been answered. I'm now more interested in verifying the accuracy of the skills that the care provider self-reports.
Currently, the Home Care Commission requires the consumer employer to verify training, experiences. We are in the process of moving more towards a competency skill-based training model that will verify skills as they are learned. But this is in consumer employed provider program, and the key to this program is that the consumer is in charge. And so we provide tools through the registry that will allow the consumer to do that. For example, when they pull a list, they receive a profile of the individual worker that includes the training classes the worker has taken, the skills that they have performed in the past and have experience with, and skills that they're willing, or tasks that they're willing to perform. This allows the consumer employer to have the tools in their hands when they're doing a screening interview. They can ask specific questions related to that information that they receive on the profile. It also could be used by their representative or family member that chooses to assist the consumer employer in their hiring process.
So it is up to the consumer, and so there really is no supervision of these care providers except by the senior.
Because they are the employer.
Senator Miles Sanders and
yes.
Megan Moyer, I think there's a distinction between the skills someone says they have versus when the Home Care Commission actually does say which classes someone took, and that is verifiable. That is a record of the Home Care Commission. So there's a little distinction there, and I want to make that clear, that you can both look at the training somebody took through the Home Care Commission, but you should ask them when they're listing the skills and their other experience.
Okay. Another question regarding paying taxes. Does the state inform the employer that if someone makes more than $1,000 a year that they are responsible for paying taxes, workers' comp, and unemployment?
They're not. Yeah, just to clarify, what this bill does is that when a consumer pays for an hour of service, that the state will then take on all of those functions on the behalf of the consumer. So the state will be paying payroll, taxes, unemployment, workers' compensation. I think that was another question about liability. Workers' compensation coverage will be elected on behalf of the consumer. So that is in this bill.
Excellent. That answers the majority of my questions. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Knope.
So Megan, everybody in the registry then is represented by your union. Is that right?
That is correct.
So you're asking us to essentially extend beyond public pay to private pay clients, right?
Yes, Senator.
Are there any instances where your union wants to go the other way and allow the private sector to compete for jobs that union members currently have?
Senator, they often do. It really depends on what we're talking about.
Well, Madam Chair, if I might, I haven't known the union to ever be in favor of essentially allowing the private sector to contract for government services. Correct.
Senator, typically it is the position of SEIU not to wish to privatize public services. That's correct.
But you're wanting us to authorize you guys to essentially compete in the private sector for these particular clients.
Representative, this is a unique employment relationship with the state where the state is only the employer of record for the purposes of collective bargaining and these administrative functions. The consumer is the employer. And it is a unique model of care where we are out there, and a lot of what we're talking about is workers, as Lee testified to, who already take private pay consumers. We have a lot of our membership who take private pay consumers, and their desire to be paid through the commission versus an individual relationship with their consumer has a lot to do with wanting that their taxes filed, wanting withholdings, wanting those hours to count toward health care benefits. The motivation behind this legislation, not only to expand options to seniors, but to be honest, is our own membership wanting to be able to have better protection for the work that they're providing out there for private consumers, and being able to do it in a way in which consumers and the worker benefit. So this is work that's already happening. Certainly members of our unit have been doing this work for a very long time for private pay, but it would allow them to do this through the commission. Yeah.
This is, admittedly, Madam Chair, more of a comment than a question. I really empathize with what Senator Rosenbaum was saying. My husband and I are solely responsible for my mother-in-law, who will be 90, please God, on the 19th of this month. And I wish that this bill had been around when we were looking. She lived in a mother-in-law apartment on our house and fell and broke both her hip and her shoulder simultaneously. And we elected to bring her home. Medicare was great for the first 10 weeks, but then she really wasn't capable of caring for herself. We worked with a private agency who ended up paying, it turns out we were basically paying half of what we were paying to the agency and half to the worker. And then when we wanted to go private, then we wanted to increase the wage that we were paying to the person providing the service, but we didn't have any way to verify any training. Because my husband's a retired reserve police officer, we were able to get a reasonable background check, but it didn't include the elder abuse issues. And then we had to pay for an accountant to do our payroll taxes because it was important to us to follow the rules, not just because I'm a legislator, because I wasn't then, but because it was the right thing to do. And I think a lot of families, that would really be asking them to go above and beyond. So we have a lot of people who are being paid to do this work where the income taxes, the payroll taxes are not being collected, which means that they don't get Social Security benefits in the long term because their income isn't reported. And in a lot of parts of the state, at least according to my medical colleagues, there aren't any private agencies to provide this. And while you may know more about the people in the community, we all know that people aren't always obvious when they... I mean, we've all heard the stories about people living next door to child abusers and murderers and say, oh, but they were the nicest person. So, frankly, the idea as a consumer of these services of somebody who's tried to get care for someone I care about very, very deeply, I wish this had been around. I appreciate Senator Knope's points, and I do think that we need to make sure that we keep options open for private industry, and I don't think this would take away any options for that. Some families would still prefer to do it that way rather than contract with the state, but the options are so limited for so many families, and people just get really scared when they have to find this kind of care, and they want to keep their elderly family members at home. So I guess that's more testimony than question, but I thought it was really important to bring my personal experience.
Thank you. Thank you very much. One last person on this bill, Joe Greenman.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Greenman. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Healthcare Association. We're a not-for-profit trade association representing over 600 long-term care facilities and over 50 private in-home licensed in-home care agencies. We support enactment of the Dash 1 amendments, and when Senator Rosenbaum mentioned the stakeholders who were involved and Megan Moyer mentioned that we were involved, that's the role that we've played here. When we saw Senate Bill 1542 as introduced, we had some fairly significant concerns with it, which caused...
Say again who you represent.
Oregon Healthcare Association.
Okay, great, yeah.
We had some concerns with Senate Bill 1542 as introduced. Megan Moyer went through section by section the Dash 1 amendment. I'll just highlight the five that we engaged heavily on. We were very concerned with the concept of assessments and service planning being involved in this process, and so we were able to agree on, in one of the sections of the Dash 1 amendment, some minimal requirements revolving around the Home Care Commission developing a tool for assessments and then requiring the home care worker to engage in a written service plan that would meet the needs of the person retaining the home care worker and matching the home care workers' skills and training. We also were concerned about seeing some sort of classifications of care being added into the registry for these private pay home care workers. That's in the Dash 1 as well. Cost transparency we're also concerned about. So each individual element of the costs that are going to go into building the hourly rate for these private pay home care workers will be individually lined out and outlined as a result of the Dash 1 amendment. We also wanted to have the Home Care Commission be responsible for making available to consumers access to information about other other resources available in the Oregon long-term care services and support system, including in-home care agencies, but also some other things that the Department of Human Services has been doing, like development of the ADRCs and the like, so that consumers, when they go to that registry, yes, they'll see the private pay home care worker, but they might, you know, the Home Care Commission will be responsible for developing some other resources that people could go to and for potential comparisons. And then finally, there were some technical issues with the language, specifically around the potential for the Home Care Commission to be delegated price fixing and price setting powers under the bill as introduced, and those, I'm happy to report, have been completely corrected and fixed under the Dash 1 amendment. So we're happy to say that that we support passage of the Dash 1 amendment.
Great.
Thank you very much. Any comments? All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1542 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1560. I just saw two young boys, and I realized that they were relatives, and I would have had you sooner because I saw the youngest getting a little antsy. All right, Len Bergstein, Dave Sanders.
Please come forward. Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Len Bergstein. I here today representing ZoomCare, an Oregon company, in support of Senate Bill 1560. Senate Bill 1560 is a modest but meaningful modernization of Oregon's telemedical statute, passed in 2009 through the efforts of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. ZoomCare has worked closely with TAO and is proud to have TAO's support communicated to this committee. What does Senate Bill 1560 fix? Current law requires insurers to pay for telecare only if two conditions are present. The patient and provider are inside a medical institution. And second, the care is not available in person. In effect, under current law, the benefits of telemedicine are not available widely. Senate Bill 1560 removes those restrictions. Opponents want you to form a work group and delay, but delay has real-world risks and negative consequences, denying access to needed care and denying healthy competition to drive down the cost of care. When we brought Senate Bill 1560 to this committee and you looked at it, members had questions about two minor sections of original 1560, and amendments to the original bill have been used to clarify or improve 1560. In particular, the Dash 1 amendment establishes standards for telemedical service as the generally accepted healthcare practices and standards prevailing in the applicable professional communities at the time the service is provided. This language would go into Section 1, Subsection 2B of the original 1560, and is the wording that's used in other statutes, and it works for other states that are wrestling with the same problem. But I think, Chair Mona Anderson, you brought up, and we attempted to deal with it directly with that amendment. Dash 4 amendment makes it clear that a telemedical service code modifier must be provided with a claim for a service provided by telecare, thus providing an important research tool and a valuable notification for insurance coverage purposes. This would allow insurers and providers to set the price for identified telemedical care that may be different than in-office visits. This modifier system would be in Section 1, Subsection 3 of the original bill. This modifier system is used in other payment models. So as I talked with all of the stakeholders, and you asked me to kind of go around and talk with, I tried to kind of offer this bill, give some opportunity for talk, and there was some confusion about the bill, some real and some imagined. So let's be clear about Senate Bill 1560, what it does, what it does not. Senate Bill 1560 increases access to care, and decreases the cost of care. It protects patient privacy by being compliant with federal laws. The words of the bill are crystal clear. Senate Bill 1560 does not mandate any new benefits. Senate Bill 1560 does not mandate additional providers to a benefit plan. Senate Bill 1560 does not set any prices for telemedical services. Senate Bill 1560 does not establish a mandated price parity between telemedical and in-office health services. The health service code is the same. The price payment does not have to be the same. Lastly, Senate Bill 1560 does not open a door to fraud. Oregon has long established laws and experience for addressing fraudulent claims. Insurers have the added protection of full access to chart reviews and medical records to be certain they only have to pay for legitimate claims. We worked with TAO, the Telemedical Alliance of Oregon. That had real benefits for me. Not only did I learn a lot about the history of the passage of 2009 and how important that was, but they vetted the bill. In effect, they operated like a work group to be able to give important constituencies and stakeholders a chance to look at this bill, and I think you'll hear later from Kathy Britton of TAO about what their reaction to this bill was. Lastly, there are real-world consequences to delay. So Senate Bill 1560 presents the legislature with a chance to act now to provide real care to people throughout Oregon who are denied access and the chance to drive down costs through competition. Senate Bill 1560 is the face of reform. And you've been here before, and you've heard the voices of the status quo raise imagined problems or confusion, telling you to watch out, stop, study, delay. But this time, delay has real consequences and real risk to the care of Oregonians. A year-long work group means 2 years of additional denying care to working families or individuals who can't make it to a medical office open 9 to 5, and denying the beneficial benefits of competition, which will drive down the cost of care. I respectfully urge you to consider the consequences of delay and pass 1560 with -1 and -5. And now I would turn over to Dave Sanders to go into depth on this matter.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Dave Sanders. I'm an Oregon physician. I'm a co-founder of ZoomCare. I'm ZoomCare CEO. We are now entering the vital period of post-health care reform, a time at which we've increased access to health insurance, but now we must demonstrate that we can increase health while decreasing costs. And to do that, we must do 4 vital things, right? We must increase access to prevention. We must manage chronic care more effectively. We must decrease excess use of emergency rooms and decrease hospital readmission rates. So 4 vital elements we must deliver upon if we're going to increase health and decrease costs. And all 4 of those things have one thing in common. They're contingent upon our ability to integrate seamlessly in-person care with remote care. We must integrate seamlessly in-person care with remote care to do all 4 of those things. We must. And I'm concerned that if we push this off into the future, 2 years, we have lost the vital window to our providers to practice, to develop the skill sets to succeed at these 4 key elements if we're going to increase health and decrease costs in this state. Now, just last week, Health Affairs, a prestigious public policy journal, published an important new study on telehealth. And that study is important to review because it really resonates with SB 1560. In fact, the section on reimbursement very much echoes and really mirrors the policy written here. I guess it's an important, I think, reinforcement of the policy we developed. So given this, why would my insurance colleagues not support this? Why would they not? I think it's important to understand that. Think about that, because it's such a solid case for integrating in-person care with remote care, with telecare. Well, look, just think about mental health. They could have covered it, but didn't. Think about wellness services. Could have covered it, but didn't. You compelled them, and Congress compelled them to cover it. Telecare fits in the same family of services. It's the same thing. Same picture, different frame. Telecare, mental health, wellness. And I think that's the overriding reason why. You'll hear other things. But I want to point out something new to you. I just learned this last week. I just learned last week that one of Oregon's major insurers, one of the largest insurers, has now contracted with an out-of-state startup telecare company to beam telecare to their Oregon members at the same time that they are saying you can't go to telecare, you can't do it, and refusing to pay primary providers in Oregon for the exact same services. So ZoomCare and others have gone through a multi-year process that with the medical board, worked out our model, have cared for thousands of Oregonians safely for 3 years on a self-pay basis, invested in building a medical home model, which is set up perfectly for integrating in-person care with remote care, telecare. And they're not going to reimburse for those services, but they will reimburse for a out-of-state startup to do the same care. So, Senators, I'm very concerned that if we postpone action now and delay effectively for 2 years to bring telecare in the proper way to the state, that we will have the worst of both worlds. Sarah, our customers will have been denied the ability to have the best health, the best price, by the lack of integration of remote care and in-person care. At the same time, we'll have a state where out-of-state providers or out-of-state systems, new companies, providing the same services in a very fragmented and decoupled way. I think that's a choice before us. I think we should act now and provide a robust framework for integrated in-person and telecare as SB 1560 allows us to do.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The RAND Corporation, just I'm looking at a study right now, RAND study cites telemedicine benefits, lowers costs, and expands access. And I think this makes a lot of sense. I do think we should do it now. But to be specific, you're asking for movement of the dash ones and the dash fives into the bill?
Fours.
And for the committee's background, the ones and the twos are identical. They got introduced by two separate requests, and they're identical. So whether it's the twos or the ones, I'm not sure what's up on all this.
Any other comments?
Yes. Madam Chair, I guess I would say this. Overall, I think this is a really good bill. I appreciate some of the concerns held by the insurance companies. I'm a little dismayed to learn what Dr. Sanders just said about one of the insurance companies contracting with an out-of-state provider. I don't quite understand that. But, you know, I had also proposed another amendment to offer a sunset on this to alleviate some of the insurers' concerns. And as of last Thursday, I was told that that, in combination with the amendments that would require the modifier and explicitly allow lower payment for telemedicine services, would satisfy the concerns. And I'm a little disappointed, frankly, to come to work on Monday morning and discover that that position has changed. Now, I understand that the person with whom I was speaking wasn't representing the entire insurance industry, and I'm not trying to impugn anyone. But, yes, change is scary, but it's not as if telemedicine is a new thing. It's just an opportunity to offer health care for people in a much more direct, personal, patient-centered way. And I do believe it has the opportunity to drive down health costs. I think you've all known me well enough to know that I'm not a fan of perpetuating the fee-for-service model. So the fact that I'm actively supporting this should say something about what I think it will do toward provision of health care and decreasing costs. I've opposed a lot of bills in the past for perpetuating a fee-for-service model. I don't love this. I wish we could get away from fee-for-service entirely, but if we're going to have it, this is a good way to do it, and I really encourage us to support it.
I would like to stay there, but I'd like Kathy Britton to offer her testimony, and then I have some questions too.
And Madam Chair, are we going to hear from the insurance companies, or is this the only testimony?
No. Oh, no. We have a list.
Kathy, are you still on the line?
Kathy.
I'm here. Thank you, Lori.
You bet.
Excuse me, Senator Moore Sanderson. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Catherine Britton. I am the program director for the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. Just as a quick aside, I have been doing telemedicine for almost 20 years. And the first program that I ran was a program in Oregon. So Oregon's been doing telemedicine for 20 years. And you'd think that we would be a lot farther along sometimes than we are. But I think that it's difficult sometimes to manage change and feel like we are providing the protections to our patients. And as such, I would like to let you know that we have an organization in the Telehealth Alliance that looks very carefully at how these particular policy changes are going to affect patients and whether we're going to be able to provide safe care, increase the access to care, and to decrease the cost of care. And as such, we have a network throughout the United States that we can use to vet some of this information and some of the policies that are occurring in other states and bring them to bear on this state. We, I don't think as a state, are required to learn all of these lessons on our own. And so being able to rely on our colleagues in other states and at the federal level allow us to look at what's being proposed and make some recommendations. We believe that the Dash 1 and Dash 4 amendments as presented address the concerns that we had originally about this bill. We think that it should address the payers' concerns about the bill. First of all, the bill is allows us to provide care in a way that reduces costs by not mandating parity, by allowing us to use the telemedical service to reduce the cost. It also allows us to reduce costs by relieving the burden on urgent and primary care outpatient services in hospitals and in urgent care clinics where the costs are substantially higher. One of the things that we know for a fact is that healthcare is moving away from institutions. And institutions are needing to look at new service lines that will allow them to reach out into the community and outside of their institutions. This allows those institutions to provide a focus on wellness and prevention and to encourage patient responsibility. This bill supports that and is allowing patients to seek care where it is most comfortable for them or where it is most useful for them. This bill allows people to go to urgent care centers and to emergency rooms when they really need that type of care. It helps patients stay safe from highly contagious illnesses that are often encountered in urgent care centers or emergency rooms, and allows them to seek the treatment that they need from their home. It keeps people with chronic conditions in their home. But we're talking about care that reduces acute care visits to emergency rooms, reduces even visits to physician offices. This is very important, not only for the reduction of costs, but for the safety of the patients involved. Transporting many of these patients is not a good idea, and it allows that patients to not have to undergo that. One of the things that we are especially interested in is that we want to be sure that people have the opportunity to get care in places that are easy for them to receive it in, such as schools, such as workplace, such as their homes. Many of the devices being developed to deliver that care are on person. People are wearing them. People are actually having them connected to their person at all times and are providing a continuous flow of information to their physicians, which allows for better care and better decisions to be made. It allows for the reduction in acute care, and it allows patients to avoid the spikes that occur sometimes in the management of chronic disease. One of the things that I wanted to comment on was the proposal in the Dash 3 amendment that creates the work group. And I wanted to concur with the group from Zoom Care that it just delays the implementation of the home monitoring and the home care by not just 8 months when this group will meet again, but by a couple of years, because we cannot encourage clinics and hospitals to develop these service lines if there's not going to be reimbursement for it. And they are not going to take the risk unless they know that they can develop these service lines and be paid for them. The development committee offers very little, under the Dash 3, offers very little expertise in the field of telemedicine. As it's written, possibly one person on that committee would have telemedicine expertise, and that's a pretty scary thought when you're looking at developing a bill that covers telemedicine. I think that this committee, in terms of my thinking, is has a very strong commitment to healthcare reform and to moving away from fee-for-service. And these kinds of services allow us to do that. Yes, they can be paid under fee-for-service, but they allow for being incorporated into the medical home model, allow for us to begin to work with the service lines and the CCOs such that they can be delivered in a managed care model and thus really help us achieve the goals of healthcare reform. So I'm hoping that you will consider this proposal with the Dash 1 and Dash 4 amendments and that you would move them forward and allow them to allow our physicians here in this state to practice more cost-effectively and access more of their patient population. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
I want to thank you, Kathy. I remember back when I was in the House, we started working on telemedicine with Senator Dave Nelson, and that was my first introduction. So thank you very much. No questions for you. Thank you, Kathy, for staying on the line for so long.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I want to see if I could ask David a question. First of all, I want to commend your assistants for hanging in there for so long. very patient and well-behaved boys. You'd mentioned that you've already gotten the buy-in from the medical board on the procedures that you're using.
Yes.
And I think you've been a serious trailblazer, and I think you should be commended for that. I'm just one thing that I'm interested in is I'd like to see other people follow in your path, and would you be open to I assume there's correspondence with the medical board about protocols and how you would you be willing to share that with other outfits that were interested in
sure.
this?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, in fact, one of the elements that came from medical board meetings 3 years ago was that Dr. Dime Girard and the faculty of OHSU asked us to do a joint research program with OHSU looking at our patient base. So that work is now coming to a conclusion and it will be published. So we'll publish our results and analysis of what's worked, what hasn't worked, and all of that. So absolutely, the answer is yes. May I just answer the question as well regarding fee-for-service? I do think there are just two important points here, and that is Kaiser has been neutral and supportive of this bill. Of course, Kaiser has offered telecare for a long time. In fact, they're thrilled, I think, to see their insurer counterparts delay on offering telecare to the marketplace. But most importantly, fee-for-service will move. The insurers today could move from fee-for-service if they wanted to partial capitation, subscription rates, fee-for-conditions. They could do it today, but they've chosen not to. But it will happen. If we pass this bill, if we do this now, what will happen now is on the next round of negotiation, the next period, we'll come back and say, so, you're paying us this for fee-for-service, for in-person care. You're paying us this for remote care. Let's now bundle these together and create a subscription rate for chronic disease management. Let's package these together for managing a wellness and preventive package service. That's how we begin to brick by brick make it happen in reality, I believe. So I do believe that by enabling this, it is going to break the logjam on moving from fee-for-service to new models like subscriptions, capitation, fee-for-condition.
And if just one follow-up comment. I hadn't thought about what Catherine mentioned, which was that you know the challenge of transporting either a very fragile elderly patient to a clinic and the risk you would put just getting in and out of the car on an icy day, or in my district where you have a very low vaccination rate, where you're bringing kids in and putting other kids at risk. It's part of that equation that I hadn't thought about.
And Madam Chair, Senator Shields, in fact, this weekend, we struggled to stay open. We were open, but we struggled to keep the system going and people coming in the clinics and doing all that. But we had a record number of telecare visits this weekend because people couldn't, we were caring for them at their homes. So it's such an important tool, which I think shows how powerful it is. They're all self-pay. People were just paying, you know, out of their pocket for that.
Under this bill, would a provider be able to prescribe narcotic drugs?
Well, this bill doesn't speak to that issue.
But it is possible online.
If I may, Madam Chair, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that, yes, it would be possible, but it would be the same standard of care that any of us would be held to when prescribing a narcotic, which is to say that we would be expected to check the prescription drug monitoring database. We would be expected to work with the pharmacy. I know we're working this year to change the regulations about how we do prescribing of controlled substances because historically, under the current Board of Pharmacy rules, we have to give a printed copy, but we're switching to e-prescribing with legislation this year, which is great. It's much safer, and it's better for the physicians and the providers in general and the patients. So I think the answer is yes. But frankly, I'd rather provide narcotics. I think in general the number of kinds of things that we would treat over the phone that we would be comfortable prescribing narcotics for is pretty darn small. I can't think of much of anything. The only time I might consider it is if I personally had a patient on a controlled substances contract who was due for their scheduled visit to meet the terms of that contract and couldn't come in because of conditions such as those we've experienced the past 4 days. And I was looking at them face to face. I wouldn't do it over the phone, but I would do it if I could look them in the eye, so to speak, and see if they were, if I felt like they were being straight with me.
Chairman Sanderson, on this clear question, what ZoomCare worked out with the OMB was to provide primary care for 27 common primary care conditions. So it's a defined universe of primary care services, and we use, as we always do, an evidence-based methodology for caring for those. So for none of those conditions is narcotics indicated. And then, of course, ZoomCare doesn't prescribe narcotics at all for anything. We don't do that. We have someone who could go to a pain specialist. So we don't do that anyway.
But this bill is written such that someone could. I only bring it to light is because a doc was punished for treating patients via Skype in Oklahoma. He actually overdosed, and it was a physician who was basically doing Skype visits. And you know, I've shared my concerns. It's tough for me to have a for-profit organization come in and want to be reimbursed for services to our Medicaid population. Right now, you get $89 a visit for a telemedicine, according to the website. You get $89, and you cover things, I guess those 27 or whatever, STDs, urinary tract infections. There was a whole list of items that you prescribe, and I'm surprised at some of the things that you're able to treat over the Skype. And so that's why I was favoring the work group, just because I think that from a provider's point of view, there needs to be some dialogue there, and having the hospitals involved and as well as the insurers. So, I mean, that's my, when I see all these things that you actually can do and get paid for, that's an issue. But the other is then we would be reimbursing you for any Medicaid clients, because you don't really cover Medicaid. You don't see Medicaid right now, correct?
Correct. And SB 1560 applies only to the commercial insurance.
Okay. Okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you.
Do you want to talk about the evidence about treating certain things?
Sure. I mean, I can. You asked about the efficacy for those primary care conditions, and the research that we're going to publish at the OHSU will show that we had a 4% technical failure rate. That is, the visit couldn't be finished because of technical issues. We had a 20% in-person.
Just get back a little bit.
20% of customers had, patients had to complete the visit in person. But the balance of customers were able to be treated using an established scientific-based methodology for diagnosis and treatment, and which we then will show have shown a very high rate of performance. And again, as Senator Shields said, Zoom Care isn't alone in this. Telecare is practiced around the United States and around the world, and has been for some time. As you know, 20 states already require commercial insurers to cover it, to cover telecare. And Medicare requires reimbursement as well. I just finished meeting with Senator Region 10 leadership last week, and it is required to be covered for underserved areas. And 47 Medicaid state plans covered. So this is not something that is that brought there. And then importantly, I mentioned that a large Oregon insurance company now has a contract with an out-of-state startup company to beam telecare to their members in Oregon, and other contracts are currently being negotiated, according to my intelligence, and will be completed soon. So we'll have a very interesting situation where insurers will have chosen a out-of-state company to provide telecare in a very sort of decoupled way, when Oregon's primary care foundation, primary care base, can't provide the same services and be reimbursed. So I think it's really important, I think, to come back to that dynamic.
Okay, so again, I'm going back to the cost then, now that I've been set straight on who would be paying. So right now, you get paid from the consumer $89. With this bill, then the insurers for their commercial insurance would be then paying you, what, $89? Or
they would negotiate a rate as they do today.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, yes.
If I may. I would say this. I think that do we need to be careful? Of course we do. I mean, that's why I proposed the sunset as a compromise to this, because that would allow us to gather data, just as Dr. Sanders has done in his study with OHSU. It's always good to gather data when you try something new. But we're not talking about treating complex medical conditions here. And more often than not, these are conditions that would take somebody to the emergency department in the middle of the night, or, you know, in the late evening, if they didn't have access to these services. And you set foot in the emergency department and you're talking about a $500 insurance bill. And the fact that people are willing to pay out of pocket for this does not mean that insurance shouldn't cover it. These should be covered services. And if the person walked in the door for their urinary tract infection or their simple rash or whatever it was that was an approved thing to treat, A, they'd take hours off of work. B, it would take away a slot from somebody who actually had a condition that couldn't be treated over telemedicine. And C, it would cost a lot more. So I'm just, these are conditions that need to get treated. And why we don't pay for them to get treated when they're covered conditions, it just baffles me. It really does. I mean, can I just ask, would you accept a sunset?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
How many do you visits do you have now that are telemedicine?
About 5,000 visits.
A year?
No, that's total. Because it's small because it hasn't been covered. So it's really self-pay customers. So
okay.
It's a small number.
Okay.
Dr. Don Girard, who is on the Oregon Medical Board, at that first meeting, and there was an interesting discussion among the board members, and Dr. Girard said, colleagues, I've been practicing telemedicine for 40 years, as all of you have, and mostly in the middle of the night, and I'm tired and over the phone. This is a vastly superior method. What's holding us up?
She's right. Thank you. Any other comments?
No, makes sense.
Okay.
Senator Mona Sanderson?
Yes.
If I might offer a couple of clarifying points. First of all, with regard to the list, this is not a list that was dreamed up by Zoom Care. When you look around the United States at the hospitals and clinics that are providing this type of care, this is a pretty standard list that people have agreed on that can be treated in this way. The other thing that's agreed on is if there's at any point the provider feels like he cannot adequately treat that patient via the telemedicine technology, he is obligated to recommend that they come in for an in-person visit. And in almost every instance that I've researched, the telemedicine fee is then applied to the in-person visit. So the patient isn't, or the healthcare payer isn't out to
yeah.
fee. So I just wanted to make those 2 points of clarification.
Thank you. Appreciate it. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, Patty O'Sullivan, John Powell, Dan Jarman.
We've only got three chairs.
And I guess who's left is Tom Holt and Kyle Gorman, but I think John Powell is.
And Jeremy.
Oh, and Jeremy Vandehey. Okay.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I want to explain our position here. Right now, people do practice telemedicine. It's very, very effective, and it's very important for our rural communities. But there's parameters around telemedicine right now, and they mirror Medicare parameters and Medicaid parameters. This bill is not asking for Medicare or Medicaid because right now Medicare will not pay for telemedicine of this kind. So telemedicine in today's world looks like this. You're in Seaside and you're in a clinic or doctor's office or a hospital emergency room or a hospital. And you have a patient that you don't have the expertise there in Seaside or Baker City or Lakeview to treat, and you want somebody to help you diagnose and treat this person. And so you call, and you normally the rural hospitals and rural clinics have contracts with OHSU, Providence, Legacy, some of the bigger health systems to get experts, and they do this quite frequently. This is kind of the way it's set up today. Medicare will pay for that. Medicaid will pay for that. But this bill does something different, and you've covered some of them. What this bill does is it changes something called the originating site. The originating site is where the patient is. Up till now, the originating site by Medicare rules and Medicaid rules to be paid, and I believe commercial, but they can cover that, are that you have to have an originating site as defined by a healthcare professional being with the patient. Okay? And then the receiving site is your expert or your other doctor or somebody who is at the receiving site. So this changes that and says, takes all the parameters around originating site away. You can be at home on your couch. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. The other thing that it changes is, up till now, historically, we've thought of telemedicine as being for rural areas. This completely changes that and says, nope, it's urban, rural. I'm not saying that's bad either. I'm just explaining where I see the differences in the bill. It's also typically, and this is not defined, but typically telemedicine is for you to go to an expert and not your normal primary care kinds of activities. This would change that. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It adds PEB and OEB as payers for telehealth as redefined in this bill. We're actually don't have an opinion on that. That's fine. They're commercial, so they should do this as well. And it has a little piece in the back about reimbursement, which is the part that Len said everybody's confused on. I'm going to leave others to talk about reimbursement. The Hospital Association is opposed to putting this bill through right now. We are not opposed to asking ourselves as a state, where's the next step for telemedicine? Are we ready for the next step? And that is something different, something defined differently as what we have now. And that's what this bill is about. We have urban hospitals who are sort of neutral on the whole thing. We have urban hospitals that don't really like the bill and want to go to a work group. We have rural hospitals that say, we think we're ready for that next step because we've got people spread out all over. But what is it going to look like, and is it safe? So I got hospitals all over the place, which leads me to say, do I oppose the bill? I don't oppose expanding telehealth if it has a good conversation and has some parameters around what you can do. We think telehealth could be expanded for follow-up surgery. You do surgery, and the person, you know, why load them into the car, send them back to the doctor's office. You could do that. You could monitor chronic disease more easily by telehealth. That's a good way to go. But using it as a primary physician one-on-one, there can be no doctor-patient relationship or history there. The person you're calling at wherever, and I'm not going to pick on any one place, but if you call there, you maybe have never been there. They have no history behind what you're currently on, what you currently have, your chronic diseases. And as you know, a lot of people can't name those. I mean, I took care of my mom. She didn't know what she was on or what she had. What do you do? How is it different than a nurse hotline? I know there's a difference. I get that. But right now, I can call a nurse hotline, which is free for my insurance, and kind of describe my symptoms, and they'll tell me to come in for a urinalysis on a urinary tract infection, or, hey, you sound like you have bronchitis. You better come in and get a chest x-ray, make sure it's not pneumonia. How is that different? I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I'm saying I believe that we need some experts to sit down at the table and look at these issues and make sure that the next step we're taking is safe for patients and that it's good, safe, effective, affordable medicine. And remember, this is only commercial insurance. Medicare will not allow this step nor pay for it at this point. Medicaid is a little different. They go by Medicare rules, except they can have some differences if they send a letter to their Medicaid, not CMS, but their state Medicaid like we have DMAP. So we are opposed but not opposed. I have gotten a note to get some amendments. I've drawn up those amendments. I have not gotten them to LC. I was going to wait till after this hearing to set up a group with doctors, hospitals, clinics, insurance carriers to look at these issues, and the Oregon Medical Board, who, to my knowledge, is is neutral, but I don't really know, to look at these issues, and I'm hoping that you will allow that. A couple of things I wanted to cover is Zoom Care has gone to OMB, and I have the minutes from their meeting back on September 7th, 2011, and they had a number of questions. I'd be glad to give this to the committee members. And sort of the same questions we're asking, and they said they'd like to continue the discussion and send it to the full board for discussion, but they asked the same exact questions that we're asking. I also have a couple of articles, about a doctor in Far Eastern Oklahoma that's been disciplined for treating patients over Skype for mental health issues, because psychiatry is an area where a lot of people are saying that this would be good for, but we need to be very careful. What happened here was he was accused of prescribing them medications without ever having physically met with them. He stated he did not think he had to actually see patients in person since they were psychiatric patients. According to the complaint against him, one patient overdosed 3 times in 6 months. The patient known as RC died while under his care, as did 2 other patients during the same time. I don't tell you that to scare you. I think psychiatry and mental health is an area that we could use this very carefully, but I did want to scare you in a bit that this is happening without states passing legislation, only for private payers. This is happening every day at Zoom Care, and that's okay. Not people dying, I'm sorry, I don't mean that, but sorry guys. but they're practicing telemedicine over Skype. So again, we are ready for that next step to look at it, but not being in a bill with 30 days and not any time to really sit and talk about it. And Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, we would not be supportive of letting it go and seeing what happens for a year. That's just, we're really concerned about patient safety here. That's our concern. And with that, I'll stop. I'm done.
Madam Chair, I know you want to hear from the members, but I have to address some of the things that Ms. O'Sullivan said. You know, OHSU practices are doing telemedicine all the time now, and we're doing it free for most of our patients because it's the right thing to do. But that means that our doctors are working and our triage nurses are working long past their scheduled work hours often. I mean, I can't tell you how many nights I've sat at home doing stuff over Epic or, you know, MyChart to provide some of these services. Ms. O'Sullivan, you mentioned that, you know, you might be seeing a patient with whom you don't have a primary care relationship. Well, first of all, that happens all the time now. I've got an urgent care less than 2 miles from my house, which doesn't do any primary care, and a significant percentage of the patients who walk in the door there have never been seen there. So there's no difference, it seems to me, treating a patient there for a simple condition than treating a patient you've never seen before when you're looking at them face-to-face but not touching their skin. Now, you can make an argument that, no, you can't take their blood pressure and you can't do all the other things. You can't do a pregnancy test on a woman to ensure she's not pregnant. I get all that. But we're already prescribing a lot of things without seeing patients. And, you know, one awful doctor in Oklahoma, I'm sorry, but that is scare tactics, and I'm a little disconcerted by that because that's just so far outside the standard of care for anybody, any physician, anywhere. I mean, the idea that you could do full-time prescribing for a patient that you've never met for a major chronic condition without collaborating with any physician nearby, I can't really imagine any thoughtful professional healthcare provider doing that. And, I mean, it's like the surgeon that we had so many problems with. Nobody thought that we had to change all of our laws or couldn't try new things because of that. I appreciate the concerns. I get it. Change is scary, but honestly, this feels like a tempest in a teacup to me. It really does. I'm sorry. I don't mean to rant, but a lot of things you said just don't jive with what's going on in the real world now, including care provided under the aegis of hospital systems.
Yeah. Or John, either one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman here representing Providence Health and Services. I wanted to underscore some of the comments made by the Hospital Association. Providence is in a very unique position because we are a hospital-based delivery system, that is involved in telemedicine. We're also an insurer. When Mr. Bergstein brought this issue to us around legislative days and asked, when he presented the concept and asked for our viewpoint on this, I can assure all of you we had a very deliberate and very well thought out conversation amongst all of the players at Providence about the policy and the bill itself. And there are some disagreements, as you've heard, some characterizations of confusion or what have you, what the bill does. This bill is written, we believe, does mandate a payment, and we have concerns with that. Mr. Bergstein says that he doesn't believe that's the case. We do. Putting that aside for a moment, there are, in the course of this conversation that we've had, there are many issues that have been raised that we think deserve a very thorough dialogue amongst all of the parties involved. I know that there was some testimony and concern with the makeup of the work group that's in a current amendment. We're actually working on a new amendment that would have a work group makeup that would include many of the telemedicine people who are doing this today and may be doing it in the future. So I think they can be addressed with all of the players who have a lot of stake at this issue. With this issue, the other point I would make is that this bill really isn't about Zoom care. I appreciate certainly the business model that they have brought here in Oregon and some of the best practices they've discussed, but this is the law of the land, and there's nothing to prevent, if this were to pass, some entity who didn't have the same business practices as Zoom care coming in, taking advantage of our laws that exist, if this were to pass, and doing some things that later on we would regret. So I would say we should think about the policy in general and not just the one business that is here pushing this legislation. And again, in our view, this just calls for a very good conversation amongst insurers, providers in the telecommunication area, physicians, the medical board, all the others who I think have a lot at stake, because the future of our medicine is very much based in telemedicine. And we're eager to have that very good system in place, but I think it just calls for a larger dialogue than just passing a bill in this very short session. Happy to answer any questions.
John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair and members, let me first of all make two notes before I address the bill itself. One, Regents has supported telemedicine. I think if you called former Senator Atkinson, who called us out by name and as far as being supportive of the last bill, he would confirm that. We have been in support of it, not only in the original telemedicine bill, but last session in a bill for diabetes chronic conditions through telemedicine. And we worked hard on those bills with Mr. DiLorenzo. So we have been supportive of telemedicine, and we remain supportive of telemedicine. And anybody that comes before this committee and tells you we're not simply is uninformed. Secondly, we supported the creation of the current model of Zoom care. Mr. Bergstein, Mr. Becker, and I had meetings in Portland. Our respective bosses asked us to come to the legislature and support allowing a broader supervision of nurse practitioners and other healthcare providers than the current model would allow, and we did so, and we do not regret it. Might tomorrow, don't today. And finally, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to look just at two sections for your benefit. The words in this bill are not confusing. They're deliberate, and they're very pointed. Those two sections are on page 1, lines 8 through 12. It defines a health care service code and a health care service code modifier. And a health service code modifier means a code added to a health care service code to indicate that the service was a telemedical health service. Okay? Remember that. A health code modifier simply tells the person receiving that code and that billing that it was telemedicine. If you turn the bill over to page 2, lines 15 through 18, it says that the insurer must reimburse a claim for telemedical health services using the same health care service code that applies to the health service when the health service is provided in person by the health professional. And then it says, this paragraph does not prohibit the use of a health care service code modifier. Well, the first sentence says it all. It's got to be the same as an in-person visit. Doesn't matter whether it's telemedical or in-person, it's going to be reimbursed the same. And that's just a very practical issue with this bill. You're telling us not to pay 80 cents or 85 cents. You're telling us to pay 100 cents. Okay, and that's pretty clear. It's very clear that that's what that combination of those sections say. And I'm not going to reiterate the comments of my two colleagues here. I think this does ask for a broader discussion. We believe telehealth has a bright future. It will be expanded, and we would not be a roadblock to that. But we do believe that it must be done methodically and clearly with the understanding of all the various participants. Thank you.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that I'm struggling with a bit, it seems like you all have a problem with how Zoom Care is providing care and how other providers would provide this kind of care. And if that's the case, I think we have an obligation in the healthcare profession to stop it from happening. This bill just seems to be about who gets to hold on to the money for a little bit longer. Does the patient have to pay out of pocket, or does the patient who has insurance expect that their insurance company would pay? Do you have a problem with, you know, that? Is it the service that you have a problem with? Because if that's the case, I mean, if you have covered lives, you should probably be coming to the legislature trying to prohibit that service from happening, don't you think?
Madam Chair, John Powell for Regents. Again, we supported the Zoom Care model. We do not oppose the methodology of providing that service in the local community. We support it because we think it gets the provider closer to the patient, and that's was the design of their model. It is something that we supported, and we do not have concern over licensed medical providers being close to their patients.
So, Madam Chair, if I could, so you all don't have a problem with Skyping to provide care, it's just you don't want to reimburse for it. Is that fair?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Senator Shields, it is the issues involved in this are not limited just to reimbursement. The reimbursement issue that I brought up is pretty clear. It mandates a level of payment, and that is objectionable to us because we believe that that form of provision of health care is less expensive than a full office visit where you have staffing and other requirements.
But you could still negotiate that, if I could, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, good question. We could negotiate it, but it would have to be the same as we paid for an in-person
call. Madam Chair, if I might, I'm a little confused now about something, Mr. Powell. I'm confused about two things. The first is, if it's going to require the use of a modifier, I'm puzzled as to why you'd have to pay the same for a visit with a modifier that designates it as a telemedicine service as you would for an in-person visit covering the same thing. I mean, it's like saying you pay the same for a 99212 and a 99213, and you wouldn't. You know, a 99213, that level of complexity, but with a modifier that says it's a telemedicine visit, I don't see why that wouldn't be plausibly reimbursed at a lower rate, maybe the equivalent of a 99212. I don't know. I mean, you guys have to figure that out among yourselves. But the other is that I thought that an amendment was being worked on to make it explicit that that didn't have to be the case. I thought that that was one of the concerns. The Dash 4s... And you think at this point, Mr. Powell, the Dash 4s do not make it explicit that it doesn't have to be reimbursed the same?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, the language of the Dash 4 amendments address lines after line 19, which is the section below the one I referred you to, and modifies that, and I do not see that it changes that.
Okay. If we were to change that, to make it explicit that you didn't have to pay, I mean, I'm still a little puzzled. Am I wrong? Let me go back. I didn't give you a chance to answer my first question. If the law requires that when this kind of service is provided, that it's billed using a specific modifier that designates it as a telemedicine service, is there a reason that you couldn't negotiate a different payment structure for that? You know, a 99213 with a whatever the code is pay reimbursed differently than a 99213 without the code that designates it's an in-person. It's an in-person visit.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, if you read the sentence that begins on line 15, page 2, I don't think you're able to differentiate, even though that the modifier says it's telemedicine, because the law would say that we must reimburse a claim for telemedical health services using the same health care service code that applies to a health care service when the health service is provided in person.
Okay. But, Mr. Powell, that wasn't my question. My question was, if we made it crystal clear that, first of all, any telemedicine service provided had to be billed with a specific code that made it crystal clear that it was a telemedicine service, and if we made it clear that you could negotiate how much you would pay for that kind of a service separate from what you would pay for the service for an equivalent condition for an in-person visit, would that satisfy, first of all, could you negotiate different rates?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I believe we do now.
Wait. Now I'm super confused. You're saying that now you negotiate different rates for telemedicine, so you are paying for telemedicine services?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, and Mr. Holt made that clear when he testified at the first hearing on this bill. Indeed, we do pay, according to the current law, for telemedical.
But that's only for the kinds of situations that Ms. O'Sullivan described, where we have the originating and the remote site hospital, and it's in essentially a JCO-approved facility as opposed to an outpatient clinic, which is not a JCO. I mean, which is not, leaving JCO aside, which is not a medical, the patient is not in a medical facility. The only times you reimburse for it is when the patient is in a medical facility. If they're sitting at their desk at their office or if they're on their couch in their home, then that doesn't meet the definition of the current law, so you're not reimbursing for it. Is that
Madam
correct?
Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I would assume that's the case, is that we do not pay for an office visit like that. Now, I may be wrong, and I'll check and get back to you.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm sorry to belabor this point, but I'm still confused, and I think it's an important distinction.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, the originating site, I'm not sure exactly what they pay for, but what this does is it takes out all of that, the hospital, the rural health clinic, and all that. So.
I understand that completely. I'm trying to clarify a couple of hypotheticals here, and I apologize if I haven't been clear. Right now, Mr. Powell, you're saying to me that if I were a perinatologist, a high-risk obstetrician practicing at Emmanuel or OHSU or St. V's, the ones with the level one nurseries, and there was a patient in John Day, a woman in preterm labor, and I was trying to work with the family doctors out there, and I billed for that, then you would, as an insurer, would pay differently to me for that service than you would if I were a perinatologist seeing that patient in my own hospital because I provide that service via telemedicine. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, before I would answer that specific question, I would have to get counsel and find out from the company exactly how that would be reimbursed.
Okay, but I thought that's what you just said, that you were already doing this, that you were paying differently for telemedicine services than in-person services.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, that is my understanding, is that telemedical services are paid for differently and at different rates.
Okay, I think that's what I just said. I mean, I'm not asking you to, you know, swear on a court of law that that's what you're doing, but I said if I were providing a telemedicine service, then you would probably reimburse me differently than if I were providing an in-person service. But that patient would be in a hospital. So there's no reason that you couldn't do exactly the same thing if it was clear that an outpatient service was being provided by telemedicine as opposed to in-person.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, If this bill passed in this form, I don't think we could.
Understood, Mr. Powell, but I'm saying that if we amended it to make it crystal clear that you could do that, then that would take away that particular objection. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Steinerhardt, that would be very helpful for that particular concern. It would not answer the other concerns.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I just maybe address the issues, because I think Senator Steinerhardt and Senator Shields are saying the same thing or have asked the same or similar questions. Putting aside the payment issue, I think it still raises other issues with this legislation as it relates to the security of the technology being used, patient safety, and these are the kind of things that we think could really benefit by having a good conversation. If, for instance, I know that this is not a practice of Zoom care, but just as an example, there's nothing in this, if this legislation were to pass, to prevent someone coming in and set up a new form of business where someone could be sitting in a Starbucks Skyping with a provider who's sitting on a beach in Cabo. Those are two-way video communications. Okay. That would be allowed under this legislation. Those are the kind of issues that we think could and should be addressed in a work group setting.
Madam Chair, if I may, Mr. Jarman, again, as a physician, I would know, based on all the HIPAA training that I've had to do as a physician, that that was completely unacceptable. I would no more communicate with a patient in that way over an unsecured connection than I would undress somebody in the middle of the hall and they said, "Doc, I have this pain in my shoulder." It's just, it would be unprofessional, and it would be, I mean, and if the patient chooses to do it in a Starbucks, well, that's their choice. I mean, it's not, I can control my end of it as a physician, and the healthcare provider should be controlling their end of it and doing it in HIPAA-compliant ways. I mean, my understanding, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, is that FaceTime is HIPAA-compliant. I'm really baffled as to why we think all of a sudden that we're going to start doing things, physicians are going to start doing things, or healthcare providers are going to start doing things in ways that they know are inconsistent with professional behavior at this point, just because of this bill. I'm very puzzled by this.
Okay. We still have some more to testify. Let's move on. Tom Holt and Kyle Gorman. Good. Just come up and say you don't have anything to say. You were signed up.
Chair Monis, Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with Regents. John Powell has spoken for me.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Monis, Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Gorman. I'm the executive officer of Clackamas Fire District Number 1, which serves about 200,000 people on the outskirts of the city of Portland. And last year, we did about 16,000 patient visits, none of which were in clinics or hospitals or other places where medical care is typically delivered. Instead, we put paramedics on the scene of all of these patients in the rural areas and in the urban areas. We are not a for-profit organization. I consider ourselves a for-patient organization. So in terms of the reimbursement piece of this, that's a little bit probably outside our scope. We want to take care of patients and take care of them in the right way. Right now, the options we have are limited. We basically have three. The patient is deceased, and they're transported by the mortuary. The patient is not ill enough or refuses transport to a local hospital, or they get transported to a hospital emergency room. The single most expensive care that you can receive in the universe. So we are really interested in other options. And by other options, I mean transporting them to places that aren't hospital emergency rooms or receiving appropriate telemedical advice on the scene that we can provide appropriate resources to these patients to keep them out of the hospital emergency rooms. Mm-hmm. We're rather mystified about this concept, this new concept of of telemedicine. We've been communicating with physicians for 40 years and receiving orders from physicians since 1974, and have given all sorts of medications during that time. And now we, in fact, activate teams at hospitals to provide better care for patients. So in trauma systems or STEMI systems or other systems, the physicians are actually acting on the evaluation that is provided by the paramedics in the field. So the out-of-hospital world is like the hospital world, is beset with this sort of perverse incentive to transport the patient, because that's the only way you get paid. And we think that there are might be some other options, as I said before. We think we can change that. We think Clackamas Fire can change that. We think that there are options that are happening now around the country with telemedicine, whether it be smartphones, whether it be tablets, what have you, that are making differences in patient lives. And you have to talk about how the reimbursement for that takes place. But it's really not necessarily about whether the physician is on the scene or not, to me, because we've been making decisions with physicians by long distance for a long period of time. What's appropriate for the patient is that the correct decision is made when the patient is on the scene, and that someone is there to communicate with a physician in medical language, and that can be in their chair, in their office, in the back seat of a car, or at home. That matters not to us. That's where we operate. And we're ready now. We can start tomorrow. We have tablets on every one of our fire engines. We can communicate voice to voice or face to face with any physician literally in the country. We have wireless hotspots that we carry with us so that we can transmit appropriate information. And we think that about 30% of our patients could benefit from not being transported to the hospital. And at $1,200 for an ambulance ride and a minimum probably $2,000 for a hospital emergency room, we're talking in the next year, if this gets delayed a year, we're talking about roughly 5,000 patients just for us that could benefit from telemedicine. So we urge you to move forward with Senate Bill 1560. I'm not going to debate the specific language of the reimbursement. We think we just need to get this going, give our people a chance to make some differences in the world and move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gorman. Appreciate you coming and sitting through our very, very long hearing.
If the kids can do it, I can
do it. That's right. Okay, Jeremy Vanderhey and then Dr. Sanders. But while I'm saying it, we're not going to hear the last bill. We will be passing out 1577, but we will not be hearing. We will carry over 1548.
Yeah, was that still on the session?
I know.
Were there any questions for me?
Seeing that, no. Okay, Jeremy.
Jeremiah Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, Jeremy Vandy with Kaiser Permanente. I just want to clarify that Kaiser does not have a position on this bill, and so anything you may have heard otherwise, we are not supportive, we are not opposed, we are neutral, we have no position.
Thank you. All right, Dr. Sanders, do clean up.
Sure. Chairman Sanderson, I wanted to address two facts that were raised by Senator Steiner-Hayward. First, we specifically worked with legislative counsel to achieve Mr. Powell's requests, and we agree with him. That is, that's the way the bill should be written, and we believe that the Dash 4s do achieve that, that it does allow you to code the visit as if it were in person for the same service. But then it does require you then to add a modifier, which indicates telemedicine visit. And I personally lead our contracting efforts, so I know how this works. Modifiers are widely used. There are many different kinds of modifiers. And the way the insurance contract will be written, it'll say, when you use a GT modifier, the insurer will pay you 25% less. In the contract, the modifier will be connected specifically to a percent discount rate. It's the way it's done today. It's the way we use in the future. It's very simple.
Thank you. Questions for him?
Oh, thank you so much for... I should have had you first. Thank you very much. There's no one else scheduled or to testify, so I will want to make sure that we carry over Senate Bill 1560 to tomorrow. We'll just keep going day by day.
Work session.
Yeah, work session. Okay. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1560 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1577.
Did we already do the amendment?
We did the amendment, correct?
Yes. Yeah. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have the fiscal...
Explain what the bill is.
Oh, okay. We just had the public hearing on Senate Bill 1577. You'll recall that this is a silver alerts bill brought forward by the Alzheimer's Association, Senator Knope, and Representative Val Hoyle. This is requiring the police department and sheriffs and the municipal police departments to communicate and relate on missing vulnerable adults on or before January 1, 2015. We do have a -1 amendment, which the committee adopted just a little bit ago. We have a no revenue impact on the -1, and we have a minimal impact on the -1 amendment as well.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1577 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1577 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any... clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steinmeier?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chairman Sanderson?
Aye. Motion carries. It goes to the floor. Senator Knope, would you carry the bill? And... we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1577. And I want to make sure that we've moved every bill over until tomorrow, correct? None went to Thursday except for
1579.
Yeah.
Right. 1579 okay. Is for Thursday.
And 1561 stays right here.
Right.
Yeah.
The work session.
1561 is gone.
1548 is getting carried over for a public hearing, possible work session tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
1542 is a work session for tomorrow only. 1582 is gone. 1577 is gone. You announced the work session carryover for 1562 and carryover work session for 1560.
And 1526.
And 15. Right. Good.
All right. Okay. Thank you. I know we could have spent about another 20 minutes or a half hour on the next bill, but I figured we've been here long enough. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks.